Beloved MTV VJ, music exec, and radio personality Matt Pinfield has spent almost four decades in front of and behind the mic. He signed bands, interviewed Beatles, and had songs written about him. But now, he's having a different conversation. He's talking with friends and supporters across the entertainment industry about their journey and how he's found his voice again, being open about his recovery. This is Sound, Sobriety, and Success.
For the last three decades, he's been the baritone in the Backstreet Boys, selling over 130 million albums worldwide. Now he's with them on the DNA World Tour well into 2023. Also has a new solo single called Smoke, with an album on its way that's coming in the new year. I caught up with AJ McLean, and the first thing we talked about is a couple of things we haven't been able to kick yet, and that's smoking and coffee. That's what I do too, man. I smoke. That's like, they were just kidding me in the studio. I got sober.
The only advice I have left, besides coffee, which is, yeah, that's going to be, I, you know, it's funny. I joke with my sponsor and I'm like, I've kicked hard drugs, I've kicked alcohol, but I honestly think these two things are going to be the most challenging thing to get rid of.
Me too. I mean, that's what it is. And it's funny, I have a new girlfriend. She's like, well, I quit smoking a few years ago, so. I mean, she said she'd prefer it, but, you know, I'm moving slow. And I think my two grown daughters are more like, and even my mom, who's 90, are like, you know what? This isn't killing you as fast. It's not one of those things.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the thing is, you know, like the shocking thing about it for me is I've been smoking pretty much since I was about 15. I took about a 2-year break off of it. And then I got in a fight with a girlfriend I was dating and I picked up a pack of Newports and started up again. And then, but since I've been a father, now that my daughters are a little bit older, now it's like they're kind of aware. So my youngest is always on my ass about, Dad, no more smoking, no more smoking. And then my oldest, if I open up a vintage bottle of cream soda, Daddy, is that alcohol? Is that alcohol? I'm like, baby, you know, Daddy does not have any alcohol in our house. Alcohol is not allowed in my house. And if somebody were to come over, like, and, you know, out of respect as a guest, bring a bottle, I'd tell them, thank you, but put it back in your car. Yeah. You know, but yeah, my two daughters are very militant with me and I love them for that because they love their daddy, but they are definitely up my butt about it lately more than ever. But it's just ironic. Like before every show, I have probably two quick smokes. I've tried doing a show. This is a sad, sad excuse, by the way, but I've tried doing a show without smoking before the show. And all of this shit comes up, this mucus and nastiness. And I'm like, okay, I just can't do it. I have to have a cigarette right before the show. And then,
you know, it's that thing they talk about, AJ, where they say that, you know, when you do actually quit smoking, that's when that stuff comes up.
Well, yeah, I mean that. And then also I've taken this 2-year pandemic to really, really dive into myself. And these past probably 6 months, I've gotten in the best shape of my life, mentally, physically, spiritually. And it's like, until I really get to my true goal, I don't want to quit smoking because I know from what I've heard, you start to eat more and you start to crave things that are not necessarily good for you, sugar and carbs and this, that, and the other. So I keep telling myself also, I don't want to quit till I'm ready. Because if I quit just to quit and then I pick up again, to me, that's a relapse. And I don't want to have that mindset, you know? So when I'm ready, I'll be ready.
Yeah, exactly. And I do plan on, you know, giving up smoking at some point. You know what I mean? And coffee, yeah. I can't say I'm going to do that. I have to have coffee. I'm like,
yeah,
you.
Coffee has become basically my lifeline since I became a dad, you know? And like when I'm home and I'm not working, I do drop off. I do pick up at school and my wife does a lot of the homework stuff. But now, you know, now that we're not doing the homeschool thing anymore, thank God my wife can breathe. She's been about to pull her hair out with, you know, as I'm sure most parents have during the pandemic, having to do homeschool. And it was causing a lot of resentments between my oldest and my, you know, wife. But now things are good. And yeah, I mean, this is my lifeline now. I drink probably 5 to 6 cups a day. And it's kind of like Ritalin for me. Like it kind of mellows me out. It doesn't give me the shakes. I don't get jittery. I could drink coffee at 10 o'clock at night and still pass out. Like, I don't know. It's just a weird, weird concept for me.
No, I have the same situation. You know, I drink coffee all different times a day. And it, again, drinking it at night does not keep me awake. You know what I mean? Eating ice cream will keep you awake.
If I have espresso, sure. That's like liquid crack. That'll just, you know, jolt me up. But I don't touch energy drinks. I don't like anything that gives me heart palpitations or anything that takes me back to when I did cocaine, even though it's not nearly as intense, but it's where my brain goes. Same thing with, we don't have soda at the house except Diet Coke. That's the only thing that my trainer said I could drink. And then it's just water. But we tried the whole LaCroix thing. We tried a bunch of the like flavored seltzer drinks and whatever, like the zero calorie ones, the Pellegrinos. But all of the flavored ones tasted like absolute flavored vodka to me without the, you know, vodka. So I can't drink them. It would literally take me back to a bad moment. And I'm like, no, not doing it.
Yeah. I mean, there are those things that definitely that resemble and trigger those tastes, smells. Like places and people, you know?
People, places and things, for sure. You know, I used to always blame my relapses on geography, and it's got nothing to do with that. My brain was already preset before I got on a flight or I drove somewhere. I knew I was going to drink. It didn't matter if I'm in Vegas, New York, LA, or Dallas, Texas. It doesn't matter. You know, I mean, as an addict, once our mind is made up, our mind is made up. It doesn't matter where we are. Now, yes, places like Vegas, it's just too easy. It's too easy. I mean, you're sitting playing blackjack and you're getting free booze. Free. So it's like, it's preset for the alcoholic to literally like be at his best, but his worst. You know, Vegas and me have been friends and we've not been friends.
Yeah. I've had the same exact experiences because, you know, when I was younger, I mean, I remember getting hammered there and then, you know, but then having, you know, those bad times there as well. And you mentioned cocaine and booze because those were my things as well. Those
was all me. I mean, you know, it started out with booze and the booze changed over the years. It started with actually Sambuca was the first thing that I really picked up because it was kind of sweet and licorice-y. And then I got alcohol poisoning, skipped over that, went straight to whiskey. Jack was my biggest vice for years before I went to treatment the first time. Then after that, when I relapsed, it became rum. There was a certain brand called Tattoo that I loved. Also kind of had a licorice-y flavor. Then it was the flavored vodkas. And then most recently, before I got sober again, it was Fireball. So it was back to the whiskey, but it was... For whatever reason, you know, my stupid alcohol brain told me, oh, well, this tastes and smells like cinnamon, so no one's going to know that it's alcohol if they smell it on my breath. They're going to think, oh, I had something cinnamony, like a cinnamon coffee or a cinnamon whatever. Yet my mannerisms, my speech, my everything was clearly fucked up. So it's like,
you know, okay. I can relate, AJ. I mean, I used to do, you know, my alcohol brain used to tell me that if I showed up for work and I ate cloves of garlic, that no one could smell the alcohol. It just smelled like garlic-flavored alcohol, really.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And it was pouring through my veins with the garlic.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So I felt bad for anybody I had to work with.
Yeah. For me, coffee for a little while became a good mask when I was trying to hide it from my wife or trying to hide it from my bandmates or my family. For at least a year, I was able to hide it with coffee or, you know, like apple juice or something like that. And then what ended up happening was when I was doing vodka for a while, I didn't realize I was allergic to potatoes. And so every time I would FaceTime with my family, my wife would see these red splotches on my face. And she knew, but she wouldn't tell me because, you know, that was her kind of in to know that I'm lying to her face. So she would just sit there and wait for me to be like, yeah, I drank tonight. But instead, I would bullshit my way out of it when in all actuality, I wasn't bullshitting anybody except myself. She knew right away. And then, of course, days or weeks later, I'd be like, oh, yeah. So when I was in wherever I did drink, I'm sorry. And she's like, oh, no, I've known. I've just been waiting for you to tell me, you know. But like my sponsor said, it worked until it didn't, you know. And This last time, I, sadly, stereotypically, I was in Vegas and I went hard. And, you know, now that I'm coming up on a year sober, now it's like with the fentanyl crisis, the opioid crisis and all these things now, I'm literally like scared stupid. And there's just no rhyme or reason to take that risk. So like,
yeah, I mean, I've guys I know that, a few people passed away who were comedians that were here in town. I knew another comedian who was hanging out with those guys and literally pulled himself out the night before those guys in LA, those three guys.
Yeah.
Passed,
I mean, died. I it's traumatic. I read about that and, I've lost about seven of my friends in the past year. I've got buddies that are out there right now that are farting around with the whole fentanyl thing. And, you know, it's just, I know that if basically my sponsor always tells me, play out the tape. And that's what I do now is I play out the tape and it's just, it literally has the exact same outcome. If I pick up a drink, sure, I might drink only for about a week, but then the blow is going to come back in and it could be one time and one time only and I'm dead. And I just don't. You know, I'm now back on the road for the first time in years, sober, but also with this little bit of fear that I have constantly that I'm forcing myself to have that fear because the minute I don't is when my ego gets in the way. And then I start telling myself, you know what? Screw it. You can have a drink. What's the big deal? And once I start even questioning that is when it's over. You know, and so I literally have that fear constantly. I talk to my sponsor daily. He's also my best friend and we've known each other for 22 years. And again, like I said, I play out the tape and it's just, you know, it's just not worth it. I didn't work this hard to get to where I am right now in this moment talking to you just to throw it all away again, you know?
No, it could be the last time. And I can relate to you completely because my thing, AJ, was I was a chronic relapser. I was,
same.
You know, I kept trying, you know, anytime something got me really upset, you know, or some life event or, I mean, I didn't even know if I needed a reason. I mean, sometimes I just wanted to get wasted or get not even wasted just to get past that anxiety level. You know what I mean? And get to that
just
one place.
Yeah. Just to numb whatever pain we always have. You know, as an addict, you're constantly living in pain until you do your steps, you get through your fourth step, which is the mother load of steps and which I'm sure on right now, you know, I'm on it and I've kind of put a pin in it for now, but I plan on picking back up when I get home. And, you know, it's the fact that I even started it. I mean, I had said I was going to start it for 20 years and I never touched it. And the minute I started touching it is when this kind of shift happened. You know, my buddies in the program say it's, you know, it's the spiritual path or the psychopath. And I spent enough time on the psychopath and in doing my four steps so far, it's been like, yes, it's been therapeutic. It's been a nice purge, but at the same time, I'm more, you know, as your sponsor will always tell you, more things are going to come up. Your four step is never done. That's why you go back to your 10th step. You know, and it's like, it's never going to be done. You're going to have to keep a daily inventory no matter what, whether you journal, whether you write it down, whether you put it in your notes, whether you share it with your sponsor or someone else that's in program. But it's like, there's just a new version of me out here on the road now that there's just a different dynamic between my bandmates, between my family and my friends. And like, if I don't talk to my sponsor for a day, he's not freaking out. Like that's where we are today. He's not like, oh crap, he didn't check in. I'm thinking the worst because again, nobody else on the road's calling him like they were. My bandmates aren't going, oh, AJ's not looking so good, guys. I don't know what's going on. It's like, it's a different time for me now. And I don't want to lose this. You know?
I mean, absolutely not, AJ. And I relate to you completely because we're very similar stories, you know? And, you know, I've got to ask you too, going back, you know, you've sold over 130 million records. I mean, you guys really paved the way. I mean, obviously there were bands who like New Kids on the Block, who you've done the double tour with and everything with earlier. But I mean, you guys, you know, set a whole new trend of things in motion and worked really hard to do it and put out a lot of great songs. And can we talk about just being a kid? Because, I mean, you know, as a kid, one of the things you got into was dance. It was something that you found really interesting. There was a love for music and the love for dance.
Yeah.
So those so tell me about that, because you put a lot of work into that, man. I mean, you were like,
I do. I'm very, very passionate about what I do. You know, I tell people that meet me for the first time, you know, that I'm a man child. Let's just get that out of the way. I'm a big Marvel fan. I have comics. I have Funko Pops. I have toys. I'm a sneakerhead. My wife hates it, but there's worse things I could have as a hobby. But I'm very awkward and kind of just free-spirited, outgoing, whatever, when I'm not on stage. When I'm on stage is when I'm the most comfortable. I feel like impenetrable. Like no one can touch me. No one's judging me in that moment. That's where my brain goes. Like I'm just in my comfort zone. I'm doing what I'm passionate about, what I love to do. And without sounding like ego-wise, I'm fucking good at it because I take pride in what I do and I enjoy seeing the people's faces in the crowd for 2 hours, forgetting about their troubles, forgetting about their job, forgetting about the stresses of whatever, and having a good time with us every night. And for me, dance was a huge thing for me when I was growing up because I got bullied a lot. I was kind of a nerdy kid, you know, instead of a backpack, I had a briefcase I took to school. You know, when Nintendo came out with the Power Glove, like that's all I wanted. My mom got it for me. I didn't like it, how it played. So I cut the cord off and I wore the glove to school because I thought it would protect me from the bullies, and it only made it worse. And I didn't have a lot of guy friends when I was younger. Girls gravitated towards me because I was the nice kid. I wasn't a pig. I wasn't, you know, grabbing at girls. I wasn't even asking girls out. I was shy, but I was a gentleman. That's just how I was raised. And all the guys hated me for it because, well, why is this dude got all the girls around him and I'm the jock or I'm the, you know, the brainiac or whatever. And so eventually I was like, I need to do something to get my mind off of all this. And I loved music as a kid. My mom raised me on Three Dog Night, CCR, Black Sabbath, Skynyrd. And then I finally moved into my own personal fan favorites of like Stevie Wonder and the Shy Lights and Prince and David Bowie and Queen, and then R&B and funk, Gap Band and Parliament. And
all great stuff.
But dancing for me was a way to express myself where I felt like, again, I felt untouchable. I felt like I was in a bubble, and I was the only boy in my early days in my dance class. It was all girls, and you know, picture this skinny twig of a guy in tights. It was a sight to see, I'll tell you that much. And dancing is what I wanted to do. Like I immediately fell in love with it. My dream was to go on tour as a backup dancer for Michael or Janet Jackson. That's all I wanted to do. And then theater came in shortly after because it was a way for me to dance and perform on stage. Acting I love. And then obviously doing musical theater, you start singing. So all of it kind of fell into place, but dancing was like was kind of the catalyst for all of it. And, you know, now jumping forward, I get to do all of that with my daily job. You know, when you shoot a music video, you're acting, you're singing, you're dancing. And even on stage, you're acting, you're singing, you're dancing. You're putting on a show, you're putting on a performance. So, you know, for me, being a performer is my escape. And now I know that like, if I'm having a tough time or I'm going through a bad patch, I'll write a song or I'll go take a dance class. Or most recently, roller skating has become a thing. Like I've got this bug to learn how to roller skate really well, and golf. I've been golfing my whole life. So there is things I can do if I'm having a bad patch where I don't have to go back to the bottle. I don't have to put a Band-Aid on, you know, or again, I talk it out. Or I write lyrics about it. And there is such a great escape from being a performer that, again, even if I'm in a rough patch, when I'm on stage, I don't think about it. I'm not thinking about anything that I'm going through. Or maybe I do. And that's what drives my passion for that song or for that moment in the show. You know, I've broken down on stage countless times because I'm going through personal shit, and a song like Show Me the Meaning of Being Lonely or Don't Want to Lose You Now hits me differently. Yeah. And all of a sudden I can't finish my verse because I have this overwhelming moment of emotion. So it is a great job to have to be able to escape, but then reality is still there and you're not escaping so far that you detach yourself. You know?
I think it's really beautiful that what you've done is, I mean, you take that, you know, your love of dance and acting. And then of course your grandmother too was involved in getting piano lessons when you were a young boy, right? Yep.
I mean, my grandmother was a amazing piano player and she aspired to be a singer, jazz singer kind of thing, but she had stage fright. So she went to do her first performance and she couldn't do it, but she taught me piano and truly was my biggest fan. I mean, honest to God, she was my biggest fan. And single parent household, I live with my mom and my grandparents, but my grandmother was the one that took me to all my auditions. She's the one that practiced my, you know, cold readings with me and was my truly my biggest fan. And when she passed away is when I really took a nosedive into, you know, alcohol and drugs, because I was mad at God. Immediately, why would you take someone like this from me? And I was crushed, you know? So,
yeah, yeah. I mean, it's life events like that can definitely affect us and send us. I know much you loved her. No question about that.
No,
you know,
I mean, and like I said, she was
with you for the time, like, right. I mean, because one of your first films you did was, you were like 8 years old with Truth or Dare, right? You were when you did
I was probably around 7 or 8 when I did Truth or Dare. Which was funny because when we had the premiere, I had to wait outside for the first 6 minutes of the film because there was nudity, which was kind of funny. And then I got to go in and watch the movie. But again, my mom worked, my grandfather worked, and my grandmother was a stay-home mom, if you want to call it that. And again, she was the one that was responsible for everything for me. And don't get me wrong, my mom is also my biggest fan. She's an incredible human being. And always is in my, you know, corner. And obviously I put all of them through hell. My grandmother thankfully never got to see me at my worst. Although she was looking down on me, seeing me at my worst. That's what really kind of drove me into the bad direction. You know, I mean, I didn't see it coming as we don't normally do. And, no. You know, I was barely drinking before that happened. But once that happened, I was just mad at the world, mad at everyone and everything. And I was just like, okay, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to go mask my pain and all this stuff. And that's exactly what I ended up doing.
I understand. You know, I mean, what resentments for me and things that, and those anger issues, not so much anger issues, like where I was one of these guys flipping out on people, because I wasn't doing that. I was a kind person. Usually I was taking most of it out of myself. But you know, it was one of those things where those resentments eat away at us, you know, and they talk about that in the program, which is resentments and secrets are the things that keep us sick. So it's like, I had to learn to deal with a lot of those things. And I just think that's great. I mean, also, I got to ask you too, because I mean, you guys have remained and been, you know, one of the biggest artists, you know, of the last 30 years and continue to have this incredible fan base. It's a combination of that. Well, you know, losing your grandmother and the pressures of being on the road, or was that like the pressure was being on the road, that the release, like you talked about before, the best moments kind of thing. And then,
yeah, I mean, I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, obviously after my grandmother passed away, I used the road as a escape because I knew when I was on stage, that was my moment to be myself and to escape. But the problem was when I'd walk off stage, I couldn't separate AJ and Alex. So AJ became in like the like forefront, the staple, and the person who could get whatever they wanted, got free booze, got in the club for free, had all the girls, blah, 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 and was just all over the place. And instead of stepping back and taking care of myself, I ran with it, you know, and I ran with it for years. You know, when I got sober the first time in 2001, I stayed sober for 7 years. And then I relapsed on again, off again, got sober again for about a year. Then it was back and forth. And I've been in and out of the rooms for since 2001. But yeah, now looking at it from a different perspective, looking back on it, I mean, like I could tell, you know, I used the road as a what I thought was a safe place to do whatever I wanted because nobody was around me. I was in my hotel rooms by myself. I could tell my security I'm going to bed and then sneak downstairs to the bar, you know, where when I was home, if I was in a relationship, I didn't have that freedom. So every time I would get on a flight to fly into wherever I was going, usually I would purposely fly in the day before. Didn't need to, but I would fly in the day before so I could get hammered, sleep it off, and then start my job. And that's just the way that I looked at things.
I know. I understand it. Believe me. I mean, done similar things. And, you know, because that was that opportunity, you know, flying on the plane, you can drink there. You can drink when you get there. You know,
yep.
I absolutely relate. But I think it's great. I mean, what's happened again in the last year for you and for me, it's been, you know, 27 months. Something changed this time around, working all the steps, realizing, you know, that we had to be part of that no matter what club that people yep. do, you know, no matter what life events are happening, had to stay committed to this and tough through them. And the way that you're doing it, like what you talked about is exactly what's worked for me as well, which is finding other things to do. It's exercising, you know, when I was yep. going out and whether it was biking, hiking, skydiving, what, you know, any of those things,
yeah.
It really helped. And, you know, that was so important because exercise was such an important part of, you know, clearing my brain as well, but also immersing myself in the program and being in touch with people in the community all the time.
Yeah.
And I still do. And it's really an incredible thing because, you know, we've met some of the greatest people ever in the program.
Yes. I mean, I've met obviously for, you know as well as I do anonymity, but I've met amazing people that are either old time musicians or actors or actresses or even just regular 9-to-5ers that I relate to. And it's like, we're all the same. Nobody has got it worse. Nobody's different. We all wear the same pants as far as addicts go. Yes, somebody may have done harder drugs than me, but the reason why and what they were feeling during that, I can relate to. You can relate to. It's the same feeling. And when the pandemic hit, a bunch of friends of mine and I, you know, Zoom blew up. I'm sure we all wish we could have got stock in Zoom, you know, before they went public. But, you know, my group of buddies, we started a Zoom meeting. We still do it every day. We have not stopped since March 16th of 2020. Every day we have the same exact meeting. It's no more than 12 of us. It's usually the same group of people. We might bring some newbies in, but like it really has been a staple. And, you know, now that in-person meetings are back again, it's been great. I want to go to meetings out here on the road. I haven't had an opportunity yet, but like I said, this time around is different. It's better. It's different, but it's where I want to stay. And I'm enjoying myself. I'm having fun. And like, I can remember what I'm doing the next day or what I did. And I can, you know, I'm talking to my kids every day and I'm sharing all these amazing stories and all these things. And I'm making new memories. I've been to all these cities before 1,000 times, but I've never been to these cities before.
I know exactly what you mean.
It's like I'm seeing things like for the first time and I'm getting out of my room. I'm not staying in my hotel room on days off like I used to do and just sit and drink and watch TV or porn or whatever the hell I was doing. It's like, no, I'm going to get out. I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to get out. I'm going to walk around. I'm going to go get some good food and I'm going to enjoy myself. Because that's what life's about. So yeah, I'm proud of myself, but I'm also not letting my ego get the better of me, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the thing you said too is, you know, it's so true. We're all the same. I always say I'm a garden variety alcoholic and addict because I've done exact same things other people have done, whether they've done, like you said, harder drugs than me or drank more. I mean, it doesn't matter because again, it's where it takes us, why we're doing it. And so I feel just like you do. I mean, that's the beauty of it is with getting this is experience and seeing things through a completely different lens, you know? And when you talk about going to the cities, it's the same thing. And then sometimes, I'm sure, AJ, you go through this exact same feeling I do, where you're like, wow, you know, I remember when I was here before, and like you said, you know, I was in my hotel room, or I was, you know, partying with people, and I, you know, just didn't even enjoy the things that were there, those options and opportunities
to explore,
you know?
Yeah. And then also I sit back and I think to myself, God, thank God there was no such thing as social media when I was at my worst, because good God, I would have been everywhere and nowhere. How I never got a DUI to this day is beyond me, knock on wood. I had a guardian angel or a few of them on my shoulder constantly, because I should have been arrested countless times. And yet, for some reason, I skated by and avoided it. And then with the social media aspect of things, like, now you just have to always assume, doesn't have to be TMZ, doesn't have to be a big ass camera. It's just somebody sitting at the bar like this watching you. You don't know. And then next thing you know, boom, you're everywhere. You're exposed. You can't hide it. You can't lie about it. And again, I have too much great things happening in my life going for me right now, with my solo music, with getting hopefully back into acting, and with coming up on 30 years as a band, being back on the road with a sold out tour, our first ever Christmas album in 29 years coming out this year, my nail polish line, clothing lines that I have, and so many more amazing aspirations that I've set for myself. It's just, why throw it all away for 20 minutes of boozing? Why? You know, it's just now I could say today confidently that the good outweighs the bad. I'm still working on myself. You know, I am very codependent. I've gotten very complacent with that. And I've gone back down that road of making sure everyone else is good, make sure everyone's happy. But I kind of lost sight of taking time out for me. So I'm really taking that time out here on the road for this next month to really, really focus on myself and really, really, you know, whether that's getting back with my therapist, whether that's going to in-person meetings or all of the above, that's what I'm going to be doing on this next month, you know?
So. Yeah, that's great, AJ. And, you know, I got to say, I'm really excited too. Your next solo record will be coming out sometime in the new year. But tell me about the single Smoke. And is some of the things, the personal things you've gone through in those lyrics? Can we talk about it?
So Smoke is when I wrote the song with some insanely talented writers. It was the last song that we wrote. We were in the studio for about 5-6 days. And we were kind of just meeting each other for the first few days, kind of getting into a groove. And the last day, I turned to my producer and I said, I really want to do something in a Prince George Michael vein, production-wise, melodically. And when he finished the track and we started writing to it, we pretty much got the verses, we got the melodies, the pre's, but we didn't have the chorus yet. And usually that's not the way I write. I go from the chorus and I go backwards. Or I come to writers with a subject or a concept, and then we go from there. And literally, it was like 11 o'clock at night. We're all burnt out. And I'm like, I cannot think of where to go with this. So I light up a cigarette. And I'm like, hold on a second. It's as easy as blowing smoke. And then we all like perked up, woke up. I grabbed a coffee at like 11:30 at night. And I'm like, we're not leaving until we finish this thing. And Smoke is just kind of that like fun, sexy love song kind of thing, where it's just like being with that person is as easy as blowing smoke. It's just, it fits, it makes sense. And the fact that sadly I am a smoker, I was like, cool, I get to smoke in the video. It's not real smoke in the video, but I get to, you know, put that in the title and it makes sense. And it's a great metaphor. There is songs that I have written over the years that are direct personal experience. I wrote a song on my first solo project that I put out only in Europe sorry, only in Asia, actually, back in 2008, a song called Sincerely Yours, which was actually the producer and I both have fathers that left. We both have abandonment issues. We both have daddy issues. And I had written a letter when I was 11 years old to my dad that I never sent. So the first verse of the song is that letter. And the second verse is something that him and I wrote together. And it's a really powerful song. And it's a really gut-wrenching song. And my dad actually flew out to Europe when I was doing shows and he heard it. And it kind of kickstarted our relationship back again. I now talk to my dad after almost 30 years. Not that often, but we do have a relationship of sorts. I'm still not like playing softball with him in the front yard and shit. But music for me is a way to express myself in all, whether it's happy, sad, angry. I wrote a song right before rehab the first time, literally called Happy. And looking back on it, lyrically, was a major cry for help. But nobody picked up on it. Nobody knew that I was hurting. Nobody knew that I was as bad as I was. I don't think I knew I was as bad as I was. But this new album is, it's such a great record. Like song for song, Smoke isn't even the best record on this album. Vocally, it's the best I've ever sounded. The songs, the vibe, the lyrical content, it's where I've always wanted to be. And I always held myself back from allowing myself to be where I am today because of my addiction. You know, I never gave myself my own full potential. And now I have, and it shows. It really, truly shows.
That's great. I mean, I'm excited to hear the rest of it. AJ, I just think it's great, too, you getting to go out there and see just the, you know, influence the band has had, how the group has had this lifelong fan base, people that are still... I've followed and loved the band for so long. It's got to be an absolutely great feeling. And just to also see, you know, experience that with your young daughters is really cool. I just think that's got to be.
They're my number one fans. I mean, they're both old enough now to know who daddy is, what daddy does. My youngest is like every day now is listening to all of my old music, to all of our new stuff, you know. Every time I FaceTime, she's got her headphones on. She's like, Daddy, I'm listening to The Caller. Daddy, I just listened to I Want to Be With You. And it's just, it's so heartwarming. And I love being a girl dad. Having girls is like the greatest thing for me. When I first found out I was going to be a dad with my oldest and it was a girl, I didn't speak to anyone for about 8 hours after I found out because I was like, of course it's a girl. It's a blessing and a curse for all the shit I did back in the day. Of course I get a girl. But I wouldn't have it any other way. And then my wife and I, 4 years later, were like, okay, we want to have another girl. And we got super lucky. We had, now we have two beautiful girls, healthy, happy. And it's just the greatest. It's the greatest gift ever. I mean, I love what I do for a living, but being a dad to me is the best job in the world because it's the most rewarding with not even a word, just a smile you get from your daughter is more rewarding than 100,000 people in a show, you know, or 130 million albums sold.
Yeah.
That's all great. But this is something that I'll never forget. And I can keep with me daily, you know? So yeah, it's phenomenal.
And they'll love you and be with you. When you get older, and it's just a really important thing. You know, I'm a father of two daughters as well. They're grown, yep. You know, but I love them more than anything in the world. And I'm so blessed and grateful that I have them. You know, it's the best thing in the world. You know, I speak to them every day. You know, I do. I just like I call my 90-year-old mother. My mom's 90. She's a sharp little Irish woman from Jersey. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so I reach out to her literally and make sure she's doing good all the time, as I promised my dad I would when he passed away, you know, right before he passed away. It's one of the last things I said to him.
That's awesome.
I got to say, AJ, I really love that you've opened it to talking about this. I think it's a great thing. I mean, it's truly, you know, the most important thing is that we, you know, stay in the center of recovery and just keep working this, you know, and going through it and sharing our experience so we can help others. most exactly. important thing in the world.
That's what it's all about, man.
But AJ, it's so great to actually get to talk to you here and meet you, man, because I know we've always crossed paths. You know what I mean? And it's, but we never hung out, you know? So I just think it's great that we're getting to know each other so well. We do, man. 100%, man. You know, I really want to do that. It's amazing.
You know, sign me up.
Yeah, we'll do that. So I just want to say thanks again, AJ, for taking the time. It was great.
My pleasure, brother.
If you or someone you know is struggling with alcoholism or addiction, Music Cares operates a mental health and addiction recovery program that understands the challenges music professionals face, no matter where they are in their career. Learn more, including if you're eligible, at musiccares.org. That's musiccares.org.
Sound, sobriety, and success with Matt Pinfield. Produced by Jake Urbanek. Engineered by Darren Silva. Jerry Ansaldo, booking. Bill Royal, research. Susan Aksu, marketing production assistant. And Laura Keeney, marketing. Sound, sobriety, and success is a Bennstown McVeigh podcast production.